Okay. All right, so thank you so much for joining. And just in case anyone here didn't hear my little disclaimer, I'm going to do this one more time. My topic is Broken Trust, the Aftermath of Trauma, and we're going to be talking about things that are very disturbing. So sexual abuse, rape, things that are very triggering. If this doesn't sound like something you want to be attending, that's totally fine, and you are welcome to leave and go to a different shear, and it will not upset or disturb or offend me, so feel free. Okay, so here we go. Today we're going to explore the lives of three women, Dina, Michal, and Tamar. And I'll remind you about who they are, because some of you will be very familiar with them and their stories, and some of you will not, and that's fine. And we're going to start with Dina. But before I launch into her life, I want to talk a little bit about how we get to this topic and why am I even talking about this topic. It's not very uplifting in the way that some other shiurim might be. So here's my question to all of you. Have you ever made a bad call? Probably yes. Most of us have. But have you ever made a bad call where you trusted a person who was absolutely the wrong person to trust? Possibly yes. A lot of us have. But have you ever made a bad call where you trusted the wrong person and you were absolutely shocked and shattered and betrayed when things didn't work out the way that you expected? Some people might have. Some people might not have. This is the story of women who had that experience. And I think that this story, these women, these experiences, are something that we grapple with still today. And so for some people, it can actually be very comforting to know that whatever kinds of difficult experiences, traumatic experiences they may have dealt with or are dealing with, it's not new. It's something that even women back in the Torah times were dealing with. And there might even be some wisdom that we can glean from their stories, how it might speak to us. So I want to start with source 3. This is a woman reflecting on a person that she really trusted, that she could not sense such treachery and dissimulation in her own lover disturbed her far more than that he'd been secretly working for the state. It was not any residue of Capers, that's his name, and his bad faith she feared, but she did not know how to ever regain trust in herself and her own judgments again. So unfortunately, if you've had the bad experience of trusting someone who was absolutely the wrong person to trust, and they shatter your trust, and you didn't see it coming, this wasn't a person where there were red flags and warning signs that you were able to tell, then where that can leave you sometimes is in this exact place, this feeling of, wow, my radar is really off, or how can I trust my own judgment? And that leaves you feeling very scarred, and that might also leave you feeling very gated or closed off or unwilling to reach out or to trust again. And unfortunately, for people who have been through what's called trauma, that can be a common reaction. And so there's a wonderful book that I highly recommend called The Body Keeps the Score. And this is all about trauma, different kinds of trauma, soldiers coming home from war, people who have experienced sexual abuse, people who have experienced rape. And this is something that not everyone knows about those experiences. Children are programmed to be fundamentally loyal to their caretakers, even if they are abused by them. Terror increases the need for attachment, even if the source of comfort is also the source of terror. I have never met a child below the age of 10 who was tortured at home and who had broken bones and burned skin to show for it, who, if given the option, would not have chosen to stay with his or her family rather than being placed in a foster home. Of course, clinging to one's abuser is not exclusive to childhood. Hostages have put up bail for their captors, expressed a wish to marry them, or had sexual relations with them. Victims of domestic violence often cover up for their abusers. None of that is happy, right? We don't want it to be that way. We want it to be very cut and dry, right? Someone is hurting a kid. The kid comes and tells a trusted adult. And of course, they leave the home of the person who's hurting them. That's not how it works. When people feel attachment to someone, they stay attached. And obviously there's ways to get out of that cycle and there's ways to remove someone from that cycle, but it's messy and it's difficult. And it's when we try to think of it as a win-win, it doesn't always feel like a win-win to all the people involved. And that's the stories that we're looking into today. All right, there's a podcast called Ear Hustle. And Ear Hustle is interesting. What it does is it goes deep into the lives of people who are prisoners in a place called San Quentin Prison. And most of the people who are there are people who have committed murder,
but there are also people there who have committed rape. And in the podcast, they talk to them, not about their crimes, but just about what life is like in a prison. But I thought that this excerpt was very instructive for the Dina story specifically. This is a man who's talking about how he involves girls, young women, in the sex trade and prostitution. And this is what he says. I'm on source number 6. You got some little girl that's walking around wearing off-brand shoes, wearing off-brand clothing, and they're isolated. Those are the people I preyed upon. I was looking for the little insecure girls that nobody wanted to be bothered with. Maybe they have some acne problems, maybe they're a little overweight, you notice the clothes they're wearing, maybe they're wearing the same outfit more than once. So on the spot is where the manipulation starts. What it is that you start spending time with this person, and say within a couple hours you've already convinced that person, one, to have sex with you, two, you're going to change their whole life. Now, unfortunately, that's a problem here in Chicago. We have at least 12,000 girls who are trafficked just through Chicago. I don't know if you knew that. So these things happen, and they happen in all communities, and it's not something we can hide from. So now we're going to get into the story of Dina. Now, Dina is the daughter of Jacob, and Jacob, as we all know, is the patriarch and the person who has the 12 sons and the 12 tribes, and it sounds like it's a really happy story. But then we get to the story of Dina, and what we see is that Dina goes out one day. She goes out to visit the daughters of the land. And the question is, what does that mean? So I'm going to go to source 10. And there's a couple of different opportunities to explain this. Some of them are more complimentary, and some of them are more judgmental. Let's put it that way. So here we have one. She went out because she goes after her mother's personality. Leah, who's her mother, goes out, so Dina also goes out. She's this extrovert. She's willing to go out. Then you have Bereshit Rabba, which is not complimentary, which is source 11, where it claims that, oh, when Leah went out to meet Yaakov, she went out and she was dressed as though she were a prostitute, and Dina also goes out dressed like a prostitute. So that's a very negative view of Dina, that she's out there in her provocative clothing, and then whatever happens to her happens to her. Now, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that source 12, has a really different view. And he looks at this person, Shechem, who's going to perpetrate violence against her. And he says, what does Shechem do? He brings dancing girls who were playing pipes in the streets. Dina went out to see those girls who were making merry, and then he seizes her and he sleeps with her. So this seems much more predatory. He's luring her out through music, and that's how it comes to be. Shadal in source 13 says, why does she go out? She wants to see the women and their fashion, you know, choices. She's interested in their style. And Abar Vanel also is a staunch defender of Dina. And what he explains is, in source 14, Dina didn't go outside with any inappropriate intentions. She went out to see the daughters of the land. It didn't say she went out to see the men of the city, but rather the daughters of the city. She wants to see the women, their garments, their jewelry, because she's the only girl in the house of Yaakov, Jacob, alone, and she wanted to learn from the other women of the city about being a young maiden. So there's a really interesting article that was published recently in Tradition. You may have heard of Tradition Magazine, Tradition Journal. It's a Jewish journal where people submit different articles about different topics. It's called The Sexual Abuse of Dina. It's a rereading of the Dina story, because when most people read the Dina story, what they see is a young maiden goes out unprotected, she's seized by Shechem, and she's raped. So he rereads the story. Dr. Dan Jacobson, who's a clinical psychologist, he's also the coordinator of the Eden Center's Chatan training program, and he sees it a little differently. Here's what he says in source 15. Dina's the youngest of the 7 children of Leah, the only daughter after 6 sons. She's the only daughter in a household of 12 boys. In this situation, there are different ways that family dynamics could play out. She could be the little princess of the household, everyone dotes on her, or she can be lost in the shuffle of a busy household. What happened in Jacob's home? It's possible that in a household with much maternal competition in the building of the family and the nation, the other 3 mothers might not necessarily fall in love with the sole daughter in the family. And what about Jacob and sons? Although they love her, they're busily occupied with bigger issues than a little girl who will most likely not be taking part in the leadership of the great project of inheriting the land of Canaan. You see that Jacob camps near Shechem, which is also Abraham's first stop in the Promised Land, and he purchases his plot of land in Canaan. The excitement among the sons surges. Young Dina is left alone. She's around the same age as Joseph, who we already know is interested in spending time with the older brothers. Maybe, after being bored with babysitting Benjamin, Dina seeks out some female companionship. She has a yearning for company. This should be echoing the ear hustle quote that I brought to you in the beginning. This is a vulnerable person who wants to be seen, wants someone to see her, wants someone to love her, wants someone to recognize her. That's the setup that we've got here. So what happens next? You look at the psukim, source 16. Vayar ota Shechem ben Hamor hachivi. Shechem sees her. Nisi ha'aretz. He's the prince of the land. He has higher status. Vayikach ota. He took her. Vayishkav ota. And he slept with her. Vayanaha. And he afflicted her. Vatidbak nafsho bedina. And then his soul clung to her. Vayahavet nahana'ara. Then he loves her. Vayadaber alev hana'ara. He speaks on or to her heart. Vayomer Shechem el Hamor aviv lemor kach li et hayalda hazot liisha. Now, you could read this and you could say he physically took her, he grabbed her, he raped her, and then after he raped her, he decided, I kind of want to have her as a wife. That's often the interpretation, but the reinterpretation says actually it's something else. It has to do with this wording, vayikach ota, he took her. Taking doesn't have to always be physical taking, and I brought you several different examples of that, so we'll look at them. So example number one, if you go to Vayikra. In Vayikra, it says, take Aharon along with his sons. Rashi says, kachenu bidvarim umashrehu. Win him over with fine words. You also see it with Korach, where Korach is taking. How is Korach taking? You look at Rashi, this is source 24. Vayikach Korach, right? Bidvarim, with words. And then you have take Yehoshua, son of Nun. This was more recent in Bamidbar 27. And I'm going to Rashi on source 27. Once again, kachanu bidvarim, take him through fine words. So now you have a picture of this vulnerable girl who's the youngest of this whole family of boys, isn't necessarily being seen, kind of lost in the shuffle. Out she goes, she wants some female companionship. Along comes this guy. He seems pretty cool. He's the prince of the land. He comes over to her, he takes her. How does he take her? He takes her through how he talks to her. Right, that's the suggestion in number 28. Right, the interaction between Shechem and Dina that ensues, it involves not one of violent coercion, but rather one of emotional manipulation, and so he's a sexual predator. The abuser chooses a child whom he sees as vulnerable, gentle, desiring attention, and poorly protected. And here's what's interesting. It's confusing what this relationship is. Okay? Because in a story of Dina where there's an aggressor who physically takes you, seizes you, rapes you, then it should be pretty clear that most people want to get away from him. Meaning, in the time of the Torah, we know that there was an idea that a woman married her rapist. So that did exist. And so there is a possibility that out of shame or out of a desire to bear children, she might want to marry her rapist. But the wording here is very different, right? The wording here is that she's with him, and after she's with him, he wants to, you know, he speaks to her lovingly and tenderly, and then he talks to her father about marrying her, and like, what is going on here? So if you look, you'll notice a couple different examples where this wording is used, where he speaks on or to her heart. And so I brought you some examples in sources 30, 31, and on. And you'll see that these are situations where people speak tenderly to their hearts, and their words are accepted. The most famous is Yosef. After Jacob dies, Yosef's brothers are very worried. Maybe all along he was only getting along with us for the sake of placating our father. But now that our father has died, now he's going to get really angry. And so he's like, no, I understand that all along this is what God wanted for me, to be in Egypt. He reassures them by Yadavar al-Libam. They seem to accept it. So if you're going to say that that's the precedent, or that's another at least place where this wording is used, then you can make the suggestion that when Shechem talks to Dina and he speaks to her heart, those words are accepted. Well, why would those words be accepted? Because this relationship is really confusing. Maybe he does love me. Maybe this is an okay relationship to be in. He says he wants to marry me. Okay, so we have these examples that this, Shechem's taking is done through persuasion rather than coercion. We're going to get to Tamar later. But one of the things that's worth bringing up right now is that often the Tamar and Dina narratives are contrasted. And for those who are unfamiliar, Tamar is a daughter of King David, and there's a very sad story in which she is raped by her half-brother, whose name is Amnon. And if you compare and contrast those stories, you'll notice some striking differences. One of them is that when it comes to Amnon taking her, he grabs her. The Hebrew has that word, right? It has the word vayachazak. He forces her, he grabs her. Moreover, we hear Tamar's voice. She desperately protests, and she says stuff like, You know, David won't withhold me from you. Don't do it this way. Instead, he'll give me in marriage. Whether she's stalling or whether she's not, we'll get to later. But it's important to note that this scenario with Dinah and that scenario with Tamar are not the same. Because when it comes to Dinah, we never hear her voice. And why don't we hear her voice? Right? Now, you could say, well, the Torah's just not interested in her voice. I mean, okay, that's a possibility, but we have plenty of other places where there are women, and like we do hear their voices, and especially in the only other real rape scene that we have with Tamar, we've got her voice on file, so why is it missing with Dinah? Well, perhaps this is the reason. Maybe this was just a very complicated, complex relationship, the kind of relationship that a predator has with someone who's being abused, your child who doesn't understand, doesn't know how to consent, and maybe the child thinks at some point this relationship is okay. Maybe even, I am being seen. I am being loved. There's someone out there who cherishes me. There's someone out there who treasures me. We as the adults all know that's not the case. But how should she have known? Okay? So, we go over to, does Dinah want to stay with Shechem? Does she want to? And this is very uncomfortable, but it's an important question. So if you look at source 36, it's a Gemara. It's a very disturbing Gemara. The Gemara says, they're talking about this wording, the wording where it says, and he afflicted her. What does it mean to afflict somebody? Vayaanaha? And there's a couple of different ways to interpret it. But one of the ways to interpret it is that Shechem afflicted her by not continuing to have sex with her. Like, she wanted him to continue. He said no. It's a disturbing Gemara, but that's the Gemara. Okay? It's right there. It's Yoma. So, again, if she was being raped, right, the way that we conceive of rape, at least nowadays, she probably doesn't want someone to continue sleeping with her because it's against her will and she's forced and so on. But if she's in some kind of predator-based relationship where she might think that there's a possibility of it being real, then it gets more complicated, right? So how do we understand this? There's an uncomfortable truth. It could be a seduction or some form of abuse. It's possible he was gentle and it did feel pleasurable. That's something people don't like to think about. But sometimes in cases where people are dealing with sexual abuse, it's not so cut and dry as here comes this person, and against the kid's will, and with the kid totally locked up and upset, they then have the relationship with them. Sometimes it could be something where it's confusing because maybe on some level you know that it's wrong, but on some other level it actually does feel pleasurable, and what do I do now with my very confused feelings? Alternatively, maybe this is her trying to assert control. She wants to feel like an equal or willing partner in this situation, even though she actually isn't. And so for her saying, well, I want you to sleep with me, you know, again or more, that's like her feeling like, oh, I really do have a role in this. Or she wants him to love her, and this is how she's going to get him to do it, right? The way that this is transactional, potentially. I'll give you sex, you love me in return. So if you turn on over to page 38, we have a disturbing excerpt from this book, The Body Keeps the Score. Kathy's talking. I brought it on myself. I was 7 years old and I loved my daddy. I wanted him to love me and I did what he wanted me to do. It was my own fault. All right, so she views this as she had agency in this situation, that she wanted her father to love her and that is the reason that she consented to the abuse. We all know that's not true, but that's how she feels it was. So if you're Dinah in this situation and if you're going with this reinterpretation, maybe that's a possibility of what's going on here. Right, and now the therapist at that time, he tried to contradict her. He's like, come on, you were just a little girl. It was your father's responsibility to maintain the boundaries. She says back to him, listen, you know, you don't get to tell me how I felt. I know that's how you want me to feel, but that's not how I felt. So you need to listen to me right now. And that's what she says, right? I instinctively blame myself for everything bad that happens to the people around me. I know it isn't rational. I feel really dumb for feeling this way, but I do. All right, so now we get to what happens next. So what happens next is that Shimon and Levi, who are Jacob's sons, come. They slay all the males in the city, and they take Dinah away. Look at the wording. Vayichu et Dinah mibet Shechem vayetzeu. They take her away. Again, we don't hear Dinah's voice. If it's a typical narrative of, you know, the man seized her, he took her, he raped her against her will, you might expect, I'm not saying everyone who's in a rape situation would respond this way, but you might expect, oh my God, you came to save me. Thank God you're here. Right? Running, desperation, happy to get away from Shechem. The wording, and they took her out of there. What happened? Now, there's a lot of possibilities. It could be she shut down completely, and they had to take her out because she wasn't moving. All right? But it could also be she didn't want to leave. Right? She thought this was a loving, consensual relationship of some kind, and therefore, for them to take her away, that was in and of itself also traumatic for her. Then it gets sadder, according to the Medrash. In the Midrash, we see that she actually becomes pregnant from this encounter. And so in source 40, what you see is that when Jacob hears this whole story, he writes on a plate of gold the story of what happened to them with Hamor, the son of Shechem. When Dinah gave birth to Asnat, he placed the gold plate around her, meaning Asnat's neck, left her by the walls of Egypt. Potiphar went out to stroll with his servants, reached the wall. He heard the crying of a newborn child, instructed his servants to fetch the child, saw the plate and the events described. Potiphar said, "This is the daughter of great people. Bring her to my home and bring a wet nurse." And because he raised her, she was called his daughter. Clearly, this midrash is borrowing from the Moshe story in terms of Moshe being taken from Bat Paro. But I think it's instructive, because what you don't see in this midrash is, where is Dinah? It looks like Dinah gets separated from her child, right? She has the baby, and then the baby is shipped off to Egypt, where the baby ends up getting taken care of. Did Dinah want to be separated from her child? Maybe yes, meaning there are situations where people who are raped or are sexually abused and become pregnant can't stand the thought of having the baby. But there's other situations where the baby is the only redeeming part of the experience. So if you look at it that way, not only does she have this very traumatic encounter to begin with, but then she gets to be re-traumatized by her own family. That's even more starkly communicated in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, where it says, the sons of Israel said she should be killed, because now people would say in all the land that there was an immoral daughter in the tents of Jacob. Right? So she's absolutely not getting any support that she might need. If she wanted to stay with her child, it seems like she wasn't given the option. Right? Everything was taken from her. So, source 43. Traumatic events are almost impossible to put into words. In Seven Pillars of Wisdom, Lawrence wrote of his war experiences, "We learned that there were pangs too sharp, griefs too deep, ecstasies too high for our finite selves to register. When emotion reached this pitch, the mind choked, and memory went white till the circumstances were humdrum once more. Silence about trauma leads to death, the death of the soul. Silence reinforces the godforsaken isolation of trauma. Being able to say aloud to another human being, 'I was raped,' or 'I was battered by my husband,' or 'My parents called it discipline, but it was abuse,' or 'I'm not making it since I got back from Iraq,' is a sign that healing can begin. We may think we can control our grief, our terror, or our shame by remaining silent, but naming offers the possibility of a different kind of control." I want to suggest that maybe there's a reason Dina's silent in the entire narrative, and maybe the reason is that she doesn't get to heal. There is no healing for Dinah in this story. There is no processing in this story. She's traumatized and she's re-traumatized. He says that being able to say aloud to another human being, "I was raped," or "I was battered by my husband," or "My parents called it discipline, but it was abuse," or "I'm not making it since I got back from Iraq," is a sign that healing can begin. That's how he sees it. Now, there is a very interesting addendum to this story that appears in the Gemara. So in the Gemara brings up someone named Eov. You may have heard of Eov because it's also referred to as the Book of Job. Job has a miserable life. The Satan comes and makes a deal with God. "I'm going to bring all kinds of pain upon this man, and I'm going to see what he does, if he'll stay loyal to you, if he won't stay loyal to you, what's going to happen with Job?" And they have this little game going on. And according to the Gemara, some say that Job lived in the days of Jacob and that he married Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And there's one line that this woman says in the book. What's the line? Source 45. "Barech Elohim vamut." Curse God and die. That's what she says. Now, if you turn on over to number 47, there's this woman called Esther Shulkis, who I don't actually know, but I loved her interpretation. So if any of you know her, you could tell her I say thank you. And this is what she says, right? Why are they making this connection? It's very tenuous. There's a word here, there's a word there, that they decide that Dinah is this woman who married Eov. So this is what she suggests. Chazal are tacitly demonstrating their reaction to the Dinah story. The point is not that this conversation is a hint that Dinah was married to Eov. This long conversation between Eov and his wife is the crux of the matter. The very reason that Chazal married Dinah off to Eov in the first place. Chazal are purposefully inserting her into this crucial conversation between Eov and his wife because Eov is the ultimate hero of the story in which bad things happen to good people. By saying the wife talking with him is Dinah, Chazal are giving Dinah a chance to vent as they feel a person in her place naturally should. Dinah, as the wife of Eov, screams out, "Curse God!" And Chazal offer Dinah an answer. Eov's response, "Are we to accept the good from God and not the bad?" And so on. All right, I don't think most of us will find Eov's response particularly compelling, But I think that the idea that Chazal deliberately insert Dina here so that Dina actually gets to have a voice, which she doesn't have in the Tanakh narrative, is very interesting. So what are our takeaways?
First of all, we could understand the story of the rape of Dina as being about the seduction, manipulation, even sexual abuse of a vulnerable child.
It exposes issues that still apply today. She has her trust broken by Shechem. It's possible that it gets compounded by decisions that are made by her brothers because they rescue her. We don't know if she really wanted to be rescued, according to this reading. And her father, who sends Asnat away, possibly not with Dina. And the line that she's given in context of her marriage to Eov speaks volumes about her entire experience. So all of that is the story of Dina. Now we're going to look at the story of another woman named Michal.
Michal is the daughter of the very first king of Israel, whose name is Shaul. Shaul has a very difficult life.
Now, it's not clear how much of this Michal is privy to, but I'm going to assume for the purposes of this discussion that she did know about it. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Before we go on to Michal, yes. So where's the resolution for Dina? Where is there any redemption? Or how is she processed this trauma?
I don't think there is. I honestly think that's the point of the story, is that sometimes, to my reading, obviously, I think sometimes stories are included because these are very human things that actually happen. And obviously, if you go with the interpretation that Eov and Dina being Eov's wife is there for a reason, they're trying to give you a resolution, which is that you accept the good from God and you accept the bad from God. But I think that's so much easier said than done. Meaning, her line, to me, is the most powerful part of the story. The fact that this is how she feels, right? Curse God and die. That's where she's at. That's what she feels. And Chazal understand that. That's why they say that this is who she is in the narrative. So to me, I think that this just gives you insight into the pain of her and her story and what she's dealing with. And to me, the thing that you're supposed to do with that is you're supposed to live that reality in our actual world. Meaning we have people in our community, you can talk to JCFS, you can talk to whomever, who have been or are sexually abused, raped, deal with domestic violence. Like, we have an opportunity to understand these stories as a call to action. This is something we need to care about. This is something we need to do something about, whether that's better education for kids and for women or whether it's more resources. But to me, I don't think there's a happy ending for her at all. And I'm not sure she really does process it. So that's my unhappy reading of it. But I think it's there. Sorry? So it's not clear how old she was. Other than that, in the birth order, she would have been similar to Yosef. And we know that Yosef is like a Na'ar in terms of his entire narrative that happens around that time. So you would imagine she would also be a Na'ara, which means she's a teenager, somewhere around there, which is very disturbing and very relatable. Okay, so now going back to Michal. Michal's the daughter of Shaul. Here's the thing. Michal grows up in a family where she's really struggling with a lot of things. First of all, her father Shaul has an evil spirit from God that was put upon him. Nowadays, most of us would understand that as a mental illness that he's dealing with. It's not exactly the same because there appears to be a point at which the evil spirit is removed and it's not mentioned anymore. But there's struggles, and David is able to calm the evil spirit. He takes his lyre, he plays upon it, things get better. So there is also a threat to the nation when Goliath comes out and he issues a challenge to everybody. And he says, you know, come and fight me, and whoever wins the battle of, like, me against an Israelite, I'll be, you know, me and my nation will be your servants, or you and your nation will be my servants. And actually, to sweeten the deal, Shaul declares that he's going to give his daughter in marriage to David. As we all know in the famous story, David takes out a stone, he kills Goliath, everything is good. And we also know that Yonatan loves David like his own soul. So here's what Michal sees. Michal sees a hero, someone who comes onto the scene. He's a beautiful guy, he's considered to have beautiful eyes. He takes this one stone, he kills a giant. He's able to go up against someone that no one else in the nation was willing to go up against. Her brother likes him a lot. And also, he's able to quell her father's dark moods. If you're Michal at this moment, of course you're going to love him, right? He is the manifestation of everything she would want in a guy at exactly that moment in time. So that's exactly what happens. If you go to source 55, Vata'ahav Michal bat Shaul et David. Michal, daughter of Shaul, fell in love with David. Here's the thing. This is really rare in the Tanakh that it says that a woman loved a man. You see it sometimes the other way around. This is super rare. But it says that this woman loved this man. Now, here's the other thing. If you look at source 56, Vayishar hadavar be'enei David lehitchatein bamelech. David was pleased with the idea of becoming the king's son-in-law.
Does he care about the woman? Does he return her feelings? Does he feel anything for her?
The text doesn't seem to say so, right? According to the text, he likes the status idea. I'll be the son-in-law of the king. That's what appeals to me about this marriage. Again, we started this whole conversation by talking about broken trust. Dina put her trust in Shechem, potentially, according to this reading. Her trust is totally shattered. Michal is about to put her trust in David. She loves him. Okay? What is she hoping for out of this marriage? We don't know because the text doesn't tell us. But it's possible that she's thinking to herself, listen, I know he loves Yonatan. I know he's able to quell my father's dark moods. Hopefully he'll love me too. That's what a lot of people might be hoping for out of a marriage. Very sadly, that's not what's going to happen for Michal at all. Okay, so first Michal saves David's life, which you see in Source 58. Michal told him, unless you run for your life tonight, you'll be killed tomorrow. She let him down. She took the household teraphim, which is like a mannequin, puts it on the bed, covers it in cloth, lies, and tells people that David is sick. So she saves his life. And then she commits one wrong choice, which is that she tells Shaul, listen, Shaul, the reason why I didn't tell you the truth is because he threatened me. He said, help me get away or I'll kill you. Now, this is a question that could be a whole shear on its own. Why does she make that choice, right? Why doesn't she tell the truth? I think the simplest explanation is she doesn't want to lose her father completely, right? Her father's ill, okay? So she doesn't want to tell him, well, I chose David over you, because that would hurt him. So instead, what she decides to play it as is, listen, he threatened me. That's why I did it. And that way she can keep her father in her life, and she can also hopefully keep David. But that's not what happens. If you look at Source 60, what you see is David takes Ahinoam of Jezreel, and he also takes Abigail, and they become his wives. So suddenly he's marrying more women. Not only is he marrying more women, Ahinoam is the name of Shaul's wife. So you could read that as he's marrying someone who's got the same name as the queen. So that's basically him asserting, I will be king. Okay? I'm not saying you have to read it that way, but you could read it that way. So then Michal gets that information, and all of a sudden you get a pasuk that Shaul gives his daughter Michal to another man, Palti son of Laish. What is going on there? Did Michal want to be given to Palti son of Laish? Right, that's a whole question. The Radak has a lengthy explanation of this, where he says there's several different possibilities. I'm going to focus on the last possibility, which is that David either was forced to write a get, which is a writ of divorce, by Shaul, or that he willingly wrote a get because he felt bad for Michal being in Anhuna, right? She's chained to him all this time while he's wandering around in caves and forests and so on. But then as he sent the get to her, he decided, actually, I don't want that get to take effect. He sent it with a shliach, which is a messenger, and the intention of the get matters. We don't allow some of these things nowadays, so this kind of mix-up couldn't happen right now in our time period, but it did happen back then. So basically the end result is, Michal, after everything she's done for David, receives a get from David. Basically, I don't want to be married to you anymore. And she decides to start over with Palti son of Laish. Now, we don't know what her feelings were. Was it that she felt like, okay, you know, I feel very betrayed after everything I've done. David is discarding me and he's sending me this get. Or is it rather that she feels like, I don't believe it. This can't be true. He's being forced into it somehow. I'm going to wait for him. Either way is sad. Okay, either way is sad. Here's what happens next. Skip forward to Source 63. There's this man called Avner. Avner was the general of Shaul. And after Shaul dies, Avner props up his son Ishbosheth, who is not a military figure at all, and he gives him power. But then there's a falling out, and because of the falling out, Avner decides he's going to defect to David's side. And he comes to David, and he makes him an amazing offer. I can get all of Israel united under your banner. Just tell me that you want me to do it. And David's like, okay, cool. But in order to do that, bring me back Michal, for whom I paid a bride price of 100 foreskins. That doesn't sound particularly loving, right? Not bring me back Michal, my wife. Bring me back Michal, who I've missed. Bring me back Michal, who I own, who belongs to me, because I paid for her with these 100 foreskins. Okay? And she comes back, and Palti, son of Laish, walks weeping behind her all the way. So trauma after trauma in terms of her trusting David and all of these things that happened to her because of it, it ends with this scene. Michal, daughter of Shaul, looked out the window. She saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord. She despised him in her heart. And she gets very upset. This is where he's dancing in front of the Aron, and she critiques him. Didn't you do yourself honor today, exposing yourself in the sight of the slave girls and so on? And the question is, like, why? Why is this so triggering to her? Why is this so upsetting to her out of all the things? So you see that in the next few sources, 66 and 67. When he danced, some of his body was revealed. The maidservants and servants saw. It was like the behavior of the loose people. And in the Midrash, we have an idea that this is actually an issue of two different households with two different identities. So when it came to her father, Shaul, Shaul was always very dignified, very regal, very modest. And here's David, who's dancing wildly before God. Right? There could not be a more opposite situation here. And David actually yells at her, right? Or it doesn't say he yells, but I imagine he yells, right? God chose me over your father. Your father didn't focus on honoring God. He rather focused on honoring himself when he disobeyed God. I'm willing to give up my own honor and to dedicate myself to God's honor. You actually have a scene where you see Shaul being very, very careful in all these areas. It's the scene in which he goes into a cave to relieve himself. And Radak informs you that there's an interpretation. He would take his cloak and he would make himself like a sukkah. He would basically cover his entire body so that when he was urinating, he did it in such a way that none of his flesh was exposed. So if Michal is reared in that man's household, and now she sees David acting totally differently, what's going through her mind? Here's what's going through her mind. I loved David. I saved his life. In return, he rejected me. He discarded me. He ran away from my father at a time when my father needed him, and joined the enemy. He joined the Philistines. He was literally marching with the Philistines in what was going to be the last battle against Shaul. For all she knows, he would have potentially attacked her own father and brother. In the end, he doesn't, because the Plishtim send him back. But it's not like the Plishtim sent him back and he decides to go join Shaul and Yonatan and fight that battle. He goes back to his own stronghold, to Ziklag, and there are problems there. So while all that's happening, okay, Shaul and Yonatan die. It would be very easy for Michal to look at this and say, wow, by letting this man into my life and into my household, I ultimately cause the death of everyone I care about, including Ishbosheth, right? Her brother gets murdered because people think that Ishbosheth's murder would please David because now he'll have full access to the throne. So you have to imagine the guilt and the despair that Michal might have felt. And then to see how unworthy he appears to be, right? Here she gave up so much, and she sees him dancing in this way that's totally the opposite of how she got raised, of what it means to be a regal and dignified monarch. That's too much. Another interpretation is, maybe she had accepted that he doesn't love her the way that she loved him. But then she sees his passion and his love and his devotion for God. For God, he can basically be parading around, you know, unclothing himself for God. He can't do it for me. He can do it for God. That was my student's interpretation. Her name is Dina Obadianik. I thought that was a very interesting reading as well. Okay, so what you get from all of this, we're going to skip forward, is go to page 73. There's something called the Gottman Institute. The Gottman Institute predicts whether marriages will end in divorce or not by watching how people interact in their love laboratory. One of the things they notice is contempt. Here's the thing that's important about contempt. Contempt is fueled by long simmering negative thoughts about the partner, which come to a head when the perpetrator attacks the accused from a position of relative superiority. Most importantly, contempt is the single greatest predictor of divorce. So when you read this scene with Michal, what you see is that she's totally contemptuous of him. And why is she contemptuous of him? I want to argue the main reason she's contemptuous of him, it's actually displaced. In the same way that what we see with Amnon, Amnon displaced is his self-hatred onto Tamar. So that after he rapes her, he throws her out because he can't stand to look at her because he hates her with a hatred that's greater than when he loved her. I think it's the same with Michal. When Michal sees David, what she sees is a symbol of basically how she ended up wrecking or helping to wreck her own family. Because think about it. If she hadn't saved his life, and if David had died that night, none of this would have happened. I mean, her father would have still had his demons, right? And David wouldn't have been around to quell them. But all of the misery that comes in her life, it comes because of that choice that she makes. That's a really sad thing to consider in terms of broken trust. Very quickly, because I know I don't really have your time anymore. I've gone a little bit longer than I anticipated. I'm just going to go through Tamar. So you see with Tamar, that Tamar is Amnon's beautiful half-sister. And what relationship would you trust more than a brother and a sister? Right? That's a relationship that everyone should be able to trust, because we're talking again about broken trust.
So far we've seen Dina's broken trust with Shechem,
and we've seen Michal's broken trust when it comes to David, and now we can get to Amnon and Tamar, right?
So this plan is hatched where Amnon is going to pretend to be sick. He's going to ask his half-sister to come in and feed him, the same way that when you're sick, sometimes you like to lie in bed and you like to have your mother or someone who loves you come and take care of you, maybe actually hand you the food, give you the bowl of chicken soup. It's the same idea, right? And so when she goes into the room, the inner room, to take care of him, he grabs her, he forces her, and what she says to him is, you know, don't do this, David will give me to you. There's a whole question of whether or not she's serious there. What I want to bring up is that there is a credible theory that she could have been serious. And here's what the credible theory is. Tamar was the daughter of Maacha, who was a Yefat Toar, which means she was captured in battle. And she was born prior to Maacha converting, which means that halakhically speaking, she isn't actually a sister of Amnon's, which means that there is a possibility that they really could have married. Okay, so what you see is with Tamar, her ending is very sad. You see it in source 76. Tamar put dust on her head, rent the ornamented tunic she was wearing, put her hands on her head, walked away screaming loudly as she went. Her brother Avshalom said to her, "Was it your brother Amnon who did this to you? For the present, sister, keep quiet about it. He is your brother. Don't brood over the matter." And Tamar remains in her brother Avshalom's house, forlorn. That last line, Bateshev Tamar b'shomema beit Avshalom achiha, shomema, this week specifically, the 9 days, and the churban, that's a word used by a churban. I want you to know that. Shomema, desolate, forlorn. When the Beit HaMikdash is completely destroyed, Jerusalem is described that way. That's how Tamar is. She is desolate, she is forlorn, she is absolutely wrecked. That's the wording. So we go back to the body keeps the score here, 78, and we see this. This woman is speaking. "I'm surrounded by all that can render life happy and agreeable. Still, to me, the faculty of enjoyment and of feeling is wanted." Right? I can't feel anything. All this would be a small matter enough, but for its frightful result, which is that of the impossibility of any other kind of feeling and of any sort of enjoyment, although I experience a need and desire of them that render my life an incomprehensible torture. And then we learn more about traumatized people. Traumatized people chronically feel unsafe inside their bodies. The past is alive in the form of gnawing interior discomfort. One of the saddest things about Tamar is that her rape is such that not only is she raped, but also she seems, at least according to the text, to never get married. And it seems like she wanted to get married because one of the things that she says to Amnon is, "When you throw me out right now and when you basically refuse to marry me, that is worse than when you raped me." Now, in contemporary times, we don't understand this, but that's how she felt, and I'm going to suggest to you why she felt that way. If you look at the Gemara in Source 80, there are 4 people that are compared to a dead person. There's a pauper, a blind person, a leper, and one who has no children. So Tamar would fit that last category. She's one who has no children. For that matter, Michal potentially fits that last category if you go according to the verse that Michal doesn't have any children till the day of her death. She also fits this category of being the walking dead. And you see an example with Eliphaz, who is stealing stuff from Yaakov. For those of you who are familiar, Source 81. Yaakov says, "Take all I have and you can say that I am dead, for a poor man may be accounted as dead." One of the ways that I think you could read this in the story of Tamar is that not only is she dead because she has no kids, she's also dead because what did she have? She had her virginity. That is the entire point of the story. That's the reason that Amnon didn't think he could act in the first place. He was like, it was hard to do anything to her because she was a virgin. He takes her virginity from her. He takes her marriage prospects from her. And he takes the fact that she might one day have kids, because no one will marry her now. And instead, she's living desolate in Avshalom's house, and it seems like that's where she lives for the rest of her life. So he literally takes it all from her. She is the walking dead. She's the walking dead according to the Gemara's understanding of what it means to be akin to a dead person. Why does this matter? So we know that in Ashkenazic tradition, you name after dead people. I'm not saying that that was necessarily the tradition of the time, but there is a curious pasuk, and this is the pasuk. And this is source 83. Va'yilavdu la'avshalom shlosha vanim ubat achat ushema Tamar, hi haita isha yifat mareh. Avshalom had 3 sons and a daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. Avshalom is the same brother who counseled Tamar to keep quiet. And he actually later on does avenge Tamar by killing her rapist, so that part does happen. But that doesn't actually help Tamar, meaning it helps her in that her rapist is dead. That doesn't give her a marriage, and that doesn't give her kids.
which, as we know from reading the Tanakh, for many women, that was some of the most important, what they wanted. You see the story of Hannah. Hannah is desperate for kids. Rachel is desperate for kids. Tamar will never have them. So it's nice that, you know, the death of her rapist, it's nice that that happened, but that doesn't give her what she wants. So I want to suggest that that ending, where he names his daughter Tamar, she's a beautiful woman, that's just very sad. It's like, you know, my sister is basically the walking dead. She's living in my house. I will name this person to be almost like a replacement for her. That's what I'll do.
I have a question. Is this a different Tamar from the Tamar with Yehuda?
Yes, totally different Tamar.
Oh,
yeah, this is a Tamar who's the daughter of David, very different time period, and that's a Tamar. No, it's good that you asked that question. Totally different women. Yes, yes. Okay, so now I'm just going to sum up the takeaways because I know some of you might need to leave and I don't want to keep you too long. Rape, sexual abuse, and domestic violence are all very real problems within the Jewish community. All three of the women that we looked at today, Dina, Michal, and Tamar, end up putting their trust in the wrong person, and they're very hurt because of the outcomes of that. All three of those women also, I didn't get into this for this year, but it's interesting to consider, they have caregivers, fathers in particular, who are not optimal, right? Yaakov potentially takes Asnat away from Dina. We don't know if Dina wanted that. He also doesn't respond. It's the brothers who decide to respond. It's not Yaakov. With Michal, Shaul, he doesn't care about her happiness. He's busy trying to kill David. He doesn't let her have the happy marriage. And when it comes to this story, the whole reason that Tamar ends up in Amnon's bedroom is because David asks her. And after it's done, David doesn't do anything. He doesn't force him to marry her. He doesn't kill him. He doesn't exile him. So I think that's another piece to this. We talked about the role of the caretaker in the lives of people and how they end up vulnerable. None of them have fathers who are reliable. All right, the ruptures and losses that they face, I think, are instructive and meaningful for us today. The fact that they existed and that their stories are still told and studied might be comforting for some people. People who might be experiencing stuff like this and feel like, is this just me? Did this ever happen before? Like, oh yeah, this happened. This happened throughout history. And for us, it's important for us to understand how deeply trauma can impact people, right? These women, their lives get interrupted. They don't get to finish the way that they should have. That's very sad. That's very tragic. And unfortunately, people who deal with trauma sometimes have that outcome as well. Obviously, there's a lot of interventions that can be done and that we want to do to support people so that they don't end up in that position. But that's something that we should be cognizant of, that we should be thinking, how can we as a community better help people who are in these situations, either to A, avoid these situations in the first place through better education and through more support and so on, or if we know someone who's in it, to try to give them whatever help they need so that they're able to hopefully get out of it and process it in a way where they can move forward.
Thank you so much. You talked about the fathers. How about the mothers?
It's interesting about the mothers, right? So in terms of Dina, we know that her mother's Leah. And we know that Leah has a very complicated marriage with Yaakov, and we don't know to what extent Leah fully bonds with or doesn't bond with Dina. It's not explored, so something to consider. Michal, we assume that it would be Ahinoam, who's her mother. We don't see any scenes of like Ahinoam and Michal. And Tamar, her mother is Macha, she's the Yifat Toar, but again, we see no scenes. So it's possible that the mothers are in the picture. We don't know to what extent or how much. But what's interesting is that we know for sure that the fathers are in the picture, and we explicitly see the fathers not reacting. And we see them called out. We see them called out in the Gemara and in the Midrash and all these places for not reacting and not doing what they could have done to help those women, which is a sad thing. I'm happy to take any other questions. I'm also happy if people need to go on to their next session. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. It's really interesting.
I'm so glad.
Are you a teacher in a school?
I am a teacher. I teach at Ida Crown, a Jewish academy.
What do you teach?